So hello, everybody. Welcome to the next episode of Presenting Our Presence. Presenting Our Presence is a podcast released on the full moon of each month that highlights the outstanding Indigenous humans that work at the University of Alberta. We get to learn about how they have come to make sense of their living at the University of Alberta. Today, we're joined by our co-hosts, Kyle Napier and Michelle DeRocher, and we have a colleague from Augustana campus. And Justin, I'll invite you to introduce yourself in the way that you are most comfortable before we begin to take the conversation. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks so much, Florence. And thanks so much for having me, and really appreciate being able to, share my experiences and have people listen to the great work that's going on at, University of Alberta. So yeah, I'm assistant professor of sociology at the Augustana campus at University of Alberta. I study social movements, nationalism and the far right in Canada, race and racism, and prisons, which is probably what we'll be focusing on today, and more specifically with Indigenous issues, how Indigenous peoples experience Canadian prisons and the programming and stuff that goes on in there. So I guess I'll leave it at that for now, and we can, kind of unpack some of that stuff.
That's great. Thank you, Justin. I just was wondering first, before we go on, can you let us know what part of Canada you're from and family in that?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm Red River Métis. I'm from Treaty One territory in Winnipeg. I guess I'll give you a bit of a background with my family. My mom, she is an Irish immigrant. She came to Canada in 1963 with her parents, or my grandparents, from Belfast. And my dad, she met him in a cafe in Winnipeg. My dad is Red River Métis. He's a descendant of Eulalie Gladue, so the sister of Louis Riel. So she would be, I think, my great-great, two-greats grandmother. And so my dad is also a child of the 60s scoop. He had many brothers and sisters. They lived on a family farm, and they were, abducted by social workers there and basically separated in foster homes across the country. And so he used to speak French. He lost his language. He went to multiple homes and ended up with a German family that spoke English. I'm not sure how to phrase this, but it really impacted my family. I lost people to substance abuse and trauma. Just as one example, I wasn't sure if I was going to talk about this, but I think it's important to know, one of my aunts was relocated to a remote northern community and was basically forced to look after a bunch of kids, and later ended her life. I also had family members who have been incarcerated. Just as kind of a amusing story, at my parents' wedding, I'll call him Uncle George. Uncle George gave my parents a VCR, and this is like the 1980s. VCRs are, they're more affordable. They're becoming really popular now, but they're still pretty expensive. And so Uncle George gave them a VCR, and they're like, "Oh, wow, like, this is so great. I can't believe you got us a VCR for our wedding gift and all that. So thanks so much." And he's like, "Oh, yeah, no problem, no problem." And they later find out that he and his friends, I guess, would rob semi-trucks, and they would hold up semi-trucks and basically unload all the VCRs. And in this case, it was VCRs. And he gifted one of these stolen VCRs to my parents. He was later incarcerated. I don't know if it was for that. It was probably for something else. But for this and other reasons, my dad and mom, I guess, kind of distanced themselves from, my dad's side of the family. And also keeping track of who is where is very challenging. And, how trauma and substance abuse gets to people as well. So I grew up with a very small family, just kind of my parents and grandparents, my mom's parents, I guess. That's where I'm at now.
Great. Thank you so much. I think we all have those relatives, right? everyone's got an auntie or an uncle that you end up having the best stories because of, some random facts about family. So thank you so much for joining us. I when we last spoke, we'd talked a little bit about sharing some of your research and everything in the prison systems. And you have mentioned just briefly here about incarceration of Indigenous people. Is that something that is being researched at Augustana and is in a supportive way? Because I find that that is kind of a hot button, if you will. So I just wanted to know, what is your experience in that research and in that sharing about Indigenous people in the prison system and prison programming?
Sure, yeah. I guess I'll just kind of explain what the project is so people know. Basically, what we do is we go inside of prisons. So I'm part of a team. Our team is the University of Alberta Prison Project. So the principal investigators are at North Campus, Dr. Sandra Becerius and Kevin Haggerty. And so this began in 2016. And so what we do is we go inside of prisons and talk to folks inside. Maybe people know this, but Indigenous peoples, they only represent about 5% of the population, but roughly anywhere from 40 to 50% of people in prison, depending on where you go. In some prisons in the prairies, Indigenous peoples represent upwards of like 72% of the population of prisoners. So obviously this is, you know, extremely relevant for us going inside and talking to folks there. So yeah, we started this in 2016, and I guess I've recently been publishing about it because these things take a long time. Like, we've interviewed about 800 incarcerated men and women so far, and we're just kind of starting to roll out the writing about this stuff. And so I published something, I guess, at the end of 2022. It's 2023 now, on Indigenized programming and how people experience that. And I guess to kind of answer your question more specifically, we really don't know, I don't want to say anything, but we know extremely little about what happens in Canadian prisons just generally. It's very rare for researchers to be able to go inside of these spaces and talk to folks inside. And so we're learning, basically everything we're learning is new. We went inside, for example, right when the opioid fentanyl crisis was going on. And so we've learned a lot. I don't write on that topic, but my colleagues do. So we've learned a lot about how drugs have kind of devastated communities and incarcerated people inside. And so we're also learning a lot about Indigenized programming that we didn't learn before. So yeah, in short, it's all very new to us, and is all, I think, exciting in some ways, but also a lot of the stuff that we're finding is, you know, just a warning for people. If we get more deep into this stuff, it is difficult content as well. We interview people, and these are often people with the worst life stories you can fathom or think of, you know, and it's, you know, going in there for 8 hours a day and interviewing people and hearing these stories for, you know, 8 to 10 hours straight is challenging. I know there's a privilege in that I get to leave, you know, and go home at the end of the day. And I don't want to, you know, suggest that, you know, I'm the person most affected by this or something like that. But it is a challenge talking to people inside, and also though important, because we had many interviews where some people literally told us, like, I've never said this to anybody before, or nobody's ever asked me about my family, or no one's ever asked me, you know, how I'm doing, you know, in the prison and that kind of thing, right? So I think it's important that people hear these stories as well.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that when we originally spoke in planning and everything, I knew, I was like, this is important work and important to hear about. But it was also like, I know that as you said, there are so many Indigenous people in the system. Mm-hmm. And I feel like everybody knows somebody who has done time for something. Mm-hmm. And in those cases where it's like, even though this is difficult to talk about, I think it's still relatable. And that's the sad truth, I think, is that this is something that affects our communities all over Canada. And I think it's really important work. When you are doing interviews in those spaces, do you find that there is a lot of there's a lot of support for you being there from the people that run those institutions?
are you talking about the administrators and that sort of thing?
Yes, yeah. The administrators or I don't know all the lingo, sorry, but when you're in there, is it a supportive space for the Indigenous people there?
Sorry, is the question about supportive space for our research? Is that kind of what you're asking?
Yes. Or,
yeah. So basically, it's mixed. I would say at the upper levels, prisons are, they want to listen. This may have, I think it does have a lot to do with the recent, you could say, uprisings in the US and in parts of Canada as well, with Black Lives Matter, lots of attention to systemic racism in prisons across, you know, North America and other parts of the world. I do think there is an appetite, so to speak, among institutions for some kind of change. And I do think that when you get to kind of higher level prison administration, they are a little more progressive, but when you get to more the frontline workers, I don't want to generalize too much, but there's a little more resistance there. So, you know, I've had interactions with prison staff, you know, they've called us like the hug a thug group, right? Like that we're like overly caring about, you know, people in prison and that sort of thing. But you also get staff who are really supportive. It is a pretty mixed bag of acceptance and resistance by people in the system. But by and large, in Canada, anyhow, I can't speak for, you know, other parts, you know, US or anything like that. But our experience is that they do want to change, and they know that there's a ton of problems. I mean, anyone who works in the system knows that there's problems. I mean, this is, I think, any system that people work in recognize that there's issues. So I do think that there's been an acceptance that, hey, we need to learn more about the people here and how we can help them. This change is always slow and glacial and all that, but I think they're people are listening. Also, now we have the calls to action, which help, you know, provide a kind of policy language that policymakers and people in these institutions are willing to listen to. So, like, related to prisons, I think calls to action 35, 36, and 37 are related to prison programming, which is what I've kind of relied on to push our research and my research interests a little bit. And having that kind of really concise policy language in the TRC and the calls to action is pretty helpful, I've found, and I have tried to rely on that. I hope that kind of answers your question. But
yeah, that answers it. Great. Thank you so much. Florence, is there anything you want to ask or comment on?
Yeah, Justin, thank you so much. I'm intrigued by the work that you're engaging in. And you also talked a bit about social movements. And and I was really curious, what brought you into this line of research? Like, what's the story you tell about how you engaged in working with, I'm going to suggest, like when I think about the prison population, you know, of Indigenous people, I mean, those voices are not very often heard. Mm-hmm. And even when we start to look at social movements, and maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, is it about the experiences of humans within social movements, or what is your line of research? And so how did you come into this line of research?
I mean, I've always kind of been interested in racial inequality generally, just in the work that I do, and related to my, you know, dad's story. I didn't learn that my dad was scooped until my 20s. And this really, I knew that he grew up poor. I knew that he grew up in foster homes. I knew that, you know, those things happened to my aunts and uncles and all that sort of stuff. But I didn't know it was connected to Canada's colonial policies. And so learning about that, that my dad was a child, not just my dad, but my entire family was, frankly, maybe destroyed, but, you know, I'm just looking for a word, but deeply impacted by the 60s scoop, really pushed me to write about this issue in particular. Going into the prisons in like 2016, how long ago was that? 6 years, you know, however long years ago, I didn't understand the I guess the degree to which overrepresentation is so bad, or like so the disparity is so striking, and we learned through the course of the research about how these programs have impacted people and how they experience these programs. And I felt, you know, I needed to write about this, because to my knowledge, there's very few or no other researchers going inside of prisons and hearing these stories. Maybe we can talk about this in a bit, but our participants really found these programs invaluable. And I thought I had to write about, I thought it was like important for me to write about what they find helps them and what they find important for their identity. And we heard a lot of stories about people who were scooped and they lost their community and they lost their Indigenous identity, and then they encountered that identity in the prison. Kind of an odd space to do that, encounter your Indigenous ancestry, your heritage, and learn about your culture. But that's what happened for a lot of people. They were completely removed from their communities, and then they encountered either people, elders, programming that taught them about colonialism and helped them better understand not just themselves, but also their families and their communities. So you would have people that are like, you know, I grew up around a lot of violence. I didn't understand why my mother or father or whoever acted this way. But now that I took this program and talked to elders and they contextualize it and I can understand it through the lens of colonialism, that really helps me like forgive my dad or like forgive whoever and understand my community better, because I know what's wrong with my community now. It's not just where, you know, the kind of so-called drunken Indian stereotype. It's way more complicated than that, right? It's all these more complicated systemic factors. So it really helped the people that we interviewed contextualize their own identity and the identities of their communities. So I thought that was really important to kind of state. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Justin, for sharing your thoughts. I know you've been deeply steeped in this research for, it seems like 15 years or so, affecting your not only your personal life, your research, your scholarship, and the center of your teaching. And so in terms of solutions or ways to look forward, you know, there's big topics like, you know, recidivism and reducing recidivism, or programming within prisons, or even, you know, larger systemic changes such as, you know, hot topic items such as, you know, defund the police.
Right.
So I'm curious for you, what have been some key learnings or key suggestions or key changes to prison reform or police reform that really would be an improvement, it seems like, for larger Canada, where we don't have this gross overrepresentation of Indigenous peoples in incarceration?
Yeah, I can't speak too much to policing, but I can definitely touch on the prison stuff. I'm not sure where to start. So kind of our biggest, I don't know, we have, related to Indigenous issues, we have a few big findings that kind of change the way we think about incarceration. One is a piece written by my colleague, Dr. Sandra Bucerius and Kevin Haggerty, on prison as a temporary refuge, which was kind of a very tragic finding of our project, where we found, particularly with Indigenous women, not just Indigenous women, but it was particularly Indigenous women, they would see prison as a place of refuge from their life on the streets, where they're, to put it another way, their life on the streets was so risky and treacherous and awful, to put it, you know, bluntly, that prison would be a place where they could get three meals a day, they could get health care for things that they may not have had health access to on the outside, mental health. And this is not me or our team or anything celebrating prison mental health services, because they're really lacking. But the fact that they're lacking so much, and that people go to prison and they find that these things are useful, even though they're so deficient, speaks, I think, a lot to the failures of not just the prison, but our society. And I think a lot of, to also connect this to Florence's point about social movements, a lot of the social movement stuff is also with police too, is directed at prisons. It's like prison's bad, police bad, we need to undo these institutions. And I sympathize with a lot of those things. However, this is always, in my opinion, much bigger than prisons. This kind of prison as a temporary refuge piece really reflects how this is not just a failure of prisons and police and the criminal justice system. It's a very, I don't want to say it's a small part, but it's a part of a much bigger failure of like education, of social services, of resources for homeless people. When you have like women who are homeless and they find safety in the prison, it's kind of it's a really difficult thing to accept, especially for prison scholars, where we want to write like prisons are frankly horrible places. You know, me or my colleagues saying that they're as a refuge is not, again, a celebration of prisons or anything like that. It's I guess painting a more complicated picture. And we also found that, you know, a lot of people feared being released from prison. So, for example, you would have men or women locked up for 30 years or more, and they'd be like, I never used a credit card before. I don't know. And everything is credit cards now, right? Or I've never used the internet before. We call this like institutionalization, where it's like you're in the prison for so long, you become institutionalized. So people tell you when to wake up, they tell you when to eat, when to sleep, when to go to work, because people have sometimes jobs in the prison. And then they're about to leave. Their family is not connected with them for 20 years. They have no friends on the outside because, you know, they've basically been abandoned. And now they're expected to return to the community and be so-called, you know, law-abiding, upstanding citizens and get a job and all these things when some of these people don't know how to use the internet and have no place to go when they get out. These are just some of the findings that it makes like how we think about prisons and also decarceration more complicated, because a response in social movements is just release everybody abolish prisons, as though it's kind of that. I know abolition discourse is more complicated than this, but getting rid of prisons or decarceration is more complicated than we think, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Also, for many women, they feared being released back because they would be returning to, let's say, abusive partners, or they would be released into homelessness. So I guess what I'm getting at is that it's not as simple as release them all. You need some kind of institutional safety net to help people along. It's not just simply let them go and we're good. There's so many other failures in society that is not just about police and prisons, that we need to really be focusing on these other institutions as well as police and prisons. So that's kind of one of the first big findings. Incarceration, decarceration is more complicated than we think. And then the other one, just quickly, is with the programming that I've been talking about. The kind of dominant narrative with indigenized programming has been that this is the new residential schools. I think someone in McLean's wrote an article about this, and it's been very popular and shared in social media. Academics have taken this and made it into academic articles. This idea, like prison programs, because they have incarcerated indigenous peoples in a space, they teach them things, that this must be the new residential schools. And we found, maybe I've made this clear already, that it's way more complicated than that. I understand prisons are horrible places. Overrepresentation is really bad. With these programs, though, the story is way more complicated. People discover their cultures for the first time. People find a ton of value in like being able to smudge inside of a prison. Healing. People we interviewed really celebrated healing lodges, which are like indigenized, like prisons run by indigenous communities or the correctional service. It's complicated. Don't really have time to get into it, but they valued healing lodges and elder visits and all these things. And so it's a lot more complicated than this is the new residential schools. People we interviewed also contrasted the programming to residential schools. So we interviewed residential school survivors who literally said, I'm so thankful that we have like a pipe ceremony on Friday because it's something for me to look forward to. And, you know, I need that to kind of cope with my residential school trauma. Women we interviewed had like beating programs, and they kind of contrasted this to residential schools. I remember one participant, she said, like, you know, with my grandparents, the Canadian government tried to exterminate the culture. And here they're, you know, this place isn't perfect, of course, but they're trying to like let us celebrate and our identity and that sort of thing. So it's not a one-to-one comparison with like residential schools and prison programming. It's a lot more complicated. So I say that in this recent publication I wrote. I guess those are the related to Indigenous issues. Those are kind of the big things we found. I'm not sure if there's other questions related to that, but there's lots more to say, but yeah.
Yeah, and Justin, that's so beautiful. I mean, as you talk about it, because I think about some of the early stories you shared with us even. And I mean, the relationship with your Uncle George was much more nuanced, right? Mm-hmm. Invited to the wedding. And that's what your research is really talking about. I think it's inviting us all to think in more nuanced ways about the system and these colonial systems where we have a high representation of Indigenous people caught in this case in the prison system. Mm-hmm. And I really thank you for that, because it is it's something that I love about research, because you can begin to dig deeper into the experiences. So do you get to talk about this in your teaching? Do you get to share some of the good work that you're doing with you and your colleagues are doing around this project in your teaching?
Yeah, I talk about it. So I teach in Intro to Indigenous Studies. I just finished teaching a course on prisons for the first time, which went really well. Students seem really receptive to, so basically when I teach these topics, I teach about Indigenous programming. I teach about also like prison gangs and drugs and that sort of thing, which is all connected back to like poverty and colonialism and that sort of stuff. And I think the students really appreciate seeing how research translates into knowledge. In other words, you know, I'll put a quote. So I'm like, here's what Bob said about, you know, the Healing Lodge or something like that, right? And it lets students kind of see, okay, this is what research looks like qualitative research anyway, because we go in and interview people. And I gives them a good understanding of like, hey, like this is real people telling their stories, and here's how we can translate that into like an academic setting, and here's how that can potentially lead to policy changes. I like to kind of show students, here's how this interview with this person translates into what could potentially lead to changes in society, if that makes sense. So I don't know if I mentioned this yet, I really try to get students interested in like policy, which is the most boring thing on earth, but I'm really trying to like emphasize we need to maybe move away is a strong word, but I'll say move away from this kind of hashtag activism of like you go on social media and you say things, or you which is important. I'm not saying that's not important, but we're kind of missing policy talk, because policy is what affects people's lives. I mean, the more I get into this research, the more you see how a tiny little policy change can affect potentially millions of people. And I don't think students, and I think some academics, don't think about these things that much, because it's not sexy, it's not fun to talk about, it's really boring to talk about, but it's really important. Like, no one wants to sit there and go through all the calls to action and how they relate to policy and that sort of thing. So I'm trying to get people more interested in policy. It's a challenge, but you know, I try to make it interesting, and I think the TRC calls to action is super important for those conversations. So there's more to talk about with teaching, but that's kind of my goals right now. So,
yeah, Justin, thank you. And that's really incredible. And I know you've been at the university for, I guess, about 18 months now. Is that correct?
And yeah, just over a year. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really amazing and fantastic that you've been able to teach a course about the prison system and that you're able to weave it into your undergraduate teaching, your other undergraduate teaching as well.
I just want to say thank you, Justin. This is really amazing and a really eye-opening. And my one last question would be, at Augustana, we did talk a little earlier about some of the other initiatives that you're working on. Are there initiatives outside of teaching that you want to highlight before we go?
Outside of teaching, we're trying to, at Augustana campus, develop the Indigenous Studies program there. Myself and Dr. Willow White and other staff and faculty are doing really good work, and we're trying to make the institution, make Augustana more welcoming for Indigenous students. I just received an email just a few days ago that we're changing the smudging policy there, which is really good. It was really kind of, I don't know, colonial, you could say, the original policy. And now we've kind of made it more open and fluid. And I'm really happy about that. So something simple like that, I think, is really important. And also, we are trying to make connections with local communities, which, as we know, is really important. Muscogee is near, pretty close to Augustana campus. And so we're trying to build our relationships with those communities. With the pandemic and some people leaving, the faculty leaving, Indigenous faculty, I should say, they had connections to those communities and they're not here anymore, unfortunately. So we're trying to like reestablish those communities in the kind of post-pandemic life or whatever phrase you want to use. So that's the kind of stuff we're working on. We'd like to make a certificate for Indigenous studies. I am developing a course for Indigenous research methods for the fall, which I'm excited about. I think it's going to be challenging, but I'm looking forward to the challenge. And yeah, I guess those are some things that I've personally been working on. I also do some work at North Campus, they have a TRC Calls to Action Committee, which with the pandemic is kind of disbanded for a little bit, but hopefully I want to get that up and running again, where we have community members and elders as well, and Indigenous faculty and students at Sociology Department North Campus kind of working together. And we created a document on decolonizing sociology, which if people listening are interested, I can share that with them, which I think very nicely lays out, you know, what does it actually mean to decolonize and how do we make it important for Indigenous peoples? Because Indigenous peoples are well aware of the issues affecting their communities. What they're, you know, what is lacking, you could say, is like the actionable part, which is what we kind of are trying to accomplish. You know, what does it mean to actually do decolonization? So yeah, those are kind of the big things I'm working on and anticipate working on in the future related to non-research, non-teaching stuff.
That's awesome. That's very exciting for me. I'm a graduate of Augustana, so there is a very special place in my heart for Augustana. And I'm just, I think it's really amazing that you and Willow and your colleagues are all working on those things to make that more of a exciting and open space for Indigenous, potential Indigenous students. So thank you.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. So yeah.
Fantastic. And first, thank you so much, Justin, again, for sharing in this research. It's so profound and necessary, and just another area where Indigenous peoples are overrepresented in this systemic, I want to say systemic oppressions. And as you're saying, it gets really complicated the more you look at it. And so just to scratch at something that that you'd raised, I'd heard personally from some friends who faced incarceration or just, you know, community connections, that the first time they've had access to ceremony or cultural revitalization is actually when they had been incarcerated. And you mentioned this a bit before and said that there wasn't really enough time to get into that topic, and you know, while you were recognizing its deep significance. Are you able to share a bit more though about that connection, right, between ceremony and culture and incarceration? Any major key tale thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So I'm trying to think of how to phrase this. I guess so many people in the prison system are victims of crime themselves, in the sense of like violence, sexual abuse. I don't know the stats offhand, but something like 85% of our sample had been the victims of violent or sexual crimes. And so what I'm getting at with this is that ceremony and cultural programming is, like, I would say, essential to healing those traumas. I think maybe listeners have heard of like a trauma-informed approach, and these are really in the early stages of development in the criminal justice system and probably other institutions as well. But I think for healing, you know, therapy, whatever word you want to use, I think it all kind of falls under the umbrella of healing mentally, physically, spiritually, all that stuff. Ceremony and indigenized programming in prisons is just essential to that. And for helping people overcome their trauma and their victimization and related to the colonial system as well, like foster care, residential schools, the Millennium Scoop and all that stuff. So I'll kind of keep it simple for now. And I guess the last thing to say is that for the future of our project, we are going to be studying reentry into the community, There's very little research dealing with this in Canada, at least the kind that we're doing. So basically what we're going to do is interview people a few weeks before their release, and then we're going to try and find them and interview them a little while after their release to see how they're doing and what resources they've used and what has helped them and what supports they have. And that will involve, reserves and local communities. It's going to be really challenging, and I'm not sure how we're going to do it, but reentry is one of just from my experience, one of the most challenging things I think to study in sociology or criminology, because it's like you're studying this transitionary, is that a word? Transitional period. And it's kind of exciting to kind of figure out how are we going to do this. And I also think it's just really important to learn, like, what do people need when they're reintegrating? So we found that the programming in the prisons has been extremely valuable for people, which I think is really important that we've learned. And now it's like, when people get out, what do they find really important? So it's kind of a continuation of that. And so we're going to be doing this over the next 7 years or so. I'm hopeful that this will lead to changes in the system. So
I'll invite you to say some final words before we close off. Is there anything else that you thought, geez, I was going to talk about, but I didn't, that you would like to add now?
No, I mean, we covered a lot, and I thank you again so much, for having me. It's really, I really want my research and my group's research and our participants' voices to be heard. And that's really all I want. So I'm really thankful for initiatives like this, and with Michelle's earlier point about what Augustana and the University of Alberta is doing, like stuff like this, I think is really great. Being able to talk about research and get Indigenous peoples interested, hopefully Indigenous students interested in how research can be used to affect change. I'll just as a quick example, I recently had the UNESCO, unfortunately I don't know what it stands for, but it's a United Nations body of the United Nations, recently emailed me about the article on prison programming, because they did the Declaration for Indigenous Human Rights in 2007 or so, I think, and this is their department, I guess, of prison education. And so they're interested in our work related to this piece, to develop kind of programming for internationally related to Indigenous education, or I guess prison education for Indigenous peoples. I'm really happy about that there's people kind of seeing the work that's being done, and it really made me more optimistic about research, because as researchers we tend to maybe be pessimistic and like, okay, we just write and write and write, nothing ever changes, and sure, things, it is very slow. But it is nice to see that there maybe is like an appetite for these kinds of changes. And I don't know how long these things are going to take, but it's important, I think, just to keep going, even though it's hard sometimes and it doesn't seem like anything's changing. I think the message here is just to keep going and do what you can with your kind of limited abilities, limited resources, whatever you can do, you just try to do. So.
Yeah, absolutely, Justin. Thank you for that. And, it is really interesting to think about how is it that our research impacts, I'm going to say, the lives of Indigenous people, and your work being picked up by the United Nations and wanting to have a conversation about it is a really outstanding example of the ways that research is impactful. And it'll go back to your policy again, and so maybe you'll have a chance to sit around and think about international policy.
Yeah,
and
fun stuff, yeah.
And all the fun stuff, because like you said, a small change in policy could change and impact the lives of a great number of humans.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you for joining us on Presenting Our Presence. I want to thank Michelle and Kyle for co-hosting today. We miss our other co-host, Dr. Cindy Gaudette. And as usual, though, we've just had an outstanding conversation. Justin, thank you for sharing this time with us and for telling the stories of your research, your family, and the work that you're doing at the University of Alberta, another outstanding example of Indigenous brilliance. that works at the University of Alberta. So